Shelley often woke up the morning after a sexual encounter with a feeling of manifest exposure, as though she'd been secretly recorded in the act of having sex, and the recording was now being screened at high resolution on her body and across her face. It was a sensation not of shame, but of transgressive near exhilaration, and that morning she had felt it even more acutely than on the day that she'd had sex for the first time. She was positive that Mira would only have to glance at her to know exactly what had happened in the night, and where, and when, and in what way. And so she'd waited until the yellow dot on her locator app was well out of sight of the shearing shed before going to join the rest of Burnham Wood for breakfast, where she was greeted, incredibly, as if it were just another sexless morning, as if she were just the same sexless person who had bid them all good night 9 hours before. Lemoyne had been a surprisingly attentive lover, more focused on her pleasure, seemingly, than on his own. The one thing that was very clear that he enjoyed was commanding her to look at him. When she obeyed, he met her gaze eagerly, seeming suddenly greedy, suddenly selfish, moving faster and breathing harder, and repeating the command the moment that she closed her eyes or turned her face aside into the pillow, such that she'd begun to disobey him, sensing correctly that this would please him even more. Afterwards, lying naked in the dark in the Darvish's spare room, he'd surprised her a second time by nuzzling into her companionably and asking in a sleepy voice if she wouldn't mind lightly raking her fingernails up and down his back, which was something that his grandmother had done when he was very young to help him fall asleep. She'd rolled to her side to face him and slipped one arm up the warm smoothness of his back like he had asked, and he had pulled her closer and sighed into her clavicle and closed his eyes and seemed to be asleep in seconds. She eased herself away from him and then lay watching him for perhaps a half hour more, wondering why he and Mira hadn't slept together, and if they ever would, and what it would be like, similar to this or very different, eventually reaching down for the duvet that was puddled at the bottom of the bed and drawing it up over them both. He didn't stir. Some hours later, she'd woken up and found him gone. She fell asleep again, and when she woke next, it was morning. She dressed quickly, wanting to get back to the camp before the others got going for the day and realized that she wasn't there, and made the bed, double-checking that he had taken with him not only the condom and the wrapper, but also the little strip along the wrapper's edge from where he'd torn it open with his teeth and then spat it out. But both the bedside table and the space beneath the bed were clear. She came out into the living room and found him sitting at the dining table, working on two laptops simultaneously. Seeing her, he shut both devices, got up and came around the table to clasp her by the upper arms and kiss her firmly on the cheek, in a gesture that made her feel both younger than she was and older.
"I'm going to keep my distance for a while," he said. "I don't want the others wondering about us. If I come down to talk to you, it'll be only in the context of the group. All right?"
"Sure," Shelley said. "Yeah, of course."
"And I warn you, I'll probably be very matter-of-fact with you and very short and to the point."
"Don't worry," she said. "You don't need to explain."
"But you should call me if you need to. Any reason, any time. I know this is going to be a tough day, so if you feel overwhelmed in any way, don't hesitate. Find a quiet place and call me."
For a moment, Shelley felt offended. "Why would today be tough?" she had just been about to say, defensively, before she realized that he wasn't talking about the fact that they'd slept together. He was talking about the funeral. "Thanks," was all she said. "I should be fine." He put his thumb against her chin and tilted her face towards him.
"That was a pretty good time last night," he said.
"Yeah," she said, blushing.
"Yeah," he said.
He smiled thoughtfully and stepped away, but then seemed to remember something.
"Oh, just before you go," he said, "I've been running some background checks, just routine security stuff, and there's this name that keeps coming up. Tony Gallo."
"Tony?" Shelley said, laughing slightly. "Oh, God."
"I want to know about him," said Lemoyne. "Who is he?"
"God," she said. "I mean, you should really be asking Mira."
"I don't trust Mira," he said. "So I'm asking you."
She was startled to hear him say as much so plainly. "God," she said again, stalling for time. "What exactly do you want to know?"
"When was the last time you saw him?"
"Not since the hooey," Shelley said. He frowned.
"What's the hooey?"
"The meeting. We took the vote on coming down here. Tony was, like, really opposed, and he and Mira had this big fight about it."
"So he's a part of Burnham Wood?"
"He was,"
Shelley said. Right back at the beginning. Then he went overseas. He's been gone for ages. Like years.
Tell me about the fight. Why was he opposed? What was the argument?
I mean, he's political, she said. You know, he's super... And well, he didn't like the idea of getting involved with you. He thought it went against our values. And also, I think he was a bit jealous, because he and Mira have this history.
They were together?
Sorry, Shelley said, laughing again. Is this really a security issue, or...
Answer me, said Lemoyne, sounding as he had the night before when he'd said, look at me.
And despite herself, she felt a stirring of arousal.
They were together?
Kind of, she said. I mean, yeah, once. But they were super close, and everyone always kind of thought they'd probably end up married one day. It was like a will-they-won't-they kind of thing.
Tell me more about the fight, said Lemoyne.
Well, Shelley said. Tony kind of lost before it even started because Mira was late, and he'd been having this whole other argument with this girl called Amber, whose cafe we were meeting in. And he was doing the whole mansplainy, Bernie bro type thing. And so when Mira finally got there, things were already kind of tense.
What happened?
He just flipped out, I guess, Shelley said. He said we were betraying everything that we believed in. And then obviously he lost the vote and he left.
And then what?
Nothing, Shelley said. Like I said, he left. That was the last time I saw him.
What about Mira?
Same as me, Shelley said. I'd be pretty surprised if they've been in touch since then. I mean, I don't even think they have each other's numbers. The Hui, that meeting, that was the first time she'd seen him since he got back from overseas. But they never really got a chance to talk, and then we left the next day to come down here, so...
Okay, Shelley, he said after a pause. That's helpful. Thanks. Let me see you out.
He led her to the front door this time, and as he opened it to usher her through, he said,
keep your phone on tonight.
Okay, Shelley said, her stomach plunging again. See ya.
Take care of yourself, he said.
Her feeling of hypervisibility persisted all the way through breakfast and throughout the morning. A little before midday, Hayden came in from the planting sites to say that a parade of 18-wheeler trucks and heavy vehicles was pouring in through the front gate. Must be the construction starting on the bunker, Shelley said, looking up from her spreadsheet. Robert said that was going to start today. The others all wanted to go and look. But just as they were setting off across the hill, it began to rain, sending them all back again. As Shelley watched them all dash for shelter, laughing, soaking wet, she realized that Mira would probably be returning shortly too. The rain was really hammering, and it showed no sign of letting up. She saved the spreadsheet she was working on and put away her laptop, announcing to no one in particular that she was heading into town to fill the van. And maybe, she said, she'd do a run to the hardware store while she was out. They could use more pea straw and another load of blood and bone. Thanks, she said when Natalie asked if she wanted company. But it might be easier if I go alone. I can fill up the front seat that way. She hadn't driven since the night she'd killed Owen Darvish. And as she put the key in the ignition and the clock on the dashboard winked to life, she saw the time and realized that his funeral was probably almost over, approaching the final hymn perhaps, the hearse standing by, the pallbearers coming forward to grip the brassy handles and hoist the coffin up. His sons, his brothers, if he had brothers, maybe a nephew, maybe a best friend. She put her seatbelt on and turned the van around to head across the field towards the gate. And she had just changed into second gear and was stepping on the gas when Lemoyne's dark-tinted SUV appeared over the crest of the hill, coming in the opposite direction. It slowed to pass her, close enough for them to nod at one another through two sets of flashing windscreen wipers. And for Shelley to see, with a jolt, that Mira was beside him. The two friends locked eyes for barely a quarter of a second before both vehicles drove on. But it was long enough for Shelley to read in Mira's expression something entirely different from the hurt and disappointed judgment she'd expected she would find there. Mira was wide-eyed and looked almost plaintive, almost despairing, as if she were desperately trying to communicate a message that she knew Shelley had not received and would not receive in time. Shelley drove on across the field to the line of poplars by the driveway, where she met the train of heavy vehicles arriving at the farm to prepare to break the ground. She slowed to a crawl, passing by the container trucks, the cement mixers, the earth movers, and the RVs, and tried to imagine for the life of her what that message might have been.